Hello, AI passengers. Jump on in. You won't want to miss today's episode, which features Eric Pellier, an entrepreneur, investor, and author dedicated to ensuring the ethical development of exponential technology with humanity top of mind. Here's what's to come on today's journey. Find out how the FII Institute has brought together a coalition of the world's greatest experts to pave the safe development of AI worldwide, and how today's guest went from tech enthusiast to leading one of the most innovative platforms in the Web3 space to a leader in artificial intelligence. Lastly, delve into what adventure in Paris and Ibiza made our guest feel most alive recently. All this and more, so take your seat.
Welcome aboard the Edge of AI podcast. Snap into your safety belt and prepare to explore the depths of the rapidly expanding AI universe. Each episode is a dispatch featuring hyper-relevant reports from the pilots, pioneers, and passengers aboard the AI rocket ship. We explore the latest use cases and developments in AI, hear from experts building tech, and learn how this disruptive force is transforming industries and society.
Welcome aboard the Edge of AI podcast. Snap into your safety belt and prepare to explore the depths of this rapidly expanding AI universe. Each episode is a dispatch featuring hyper-relevant reports from the pilots, pioneers, and passengers aboard the AI rocket ship. We explore the latest use cases and developments in AI, hear from experts building the tech, and empower you to enhance your life with AI and learn how this disruptive force is transforming industries and society. I'm your captain, Josh Krieger, and I have an insatiable curiosity for disruptive ideas and technology, which has led me in a cross-industry entrepreneurial journey building transformative companies. As co-founder of EdgeOf Company, I've hosted over 300 conversations with emerging tech leaders, and artificial intelligence has been a key part of these conversations and my toolkit for quite a long time. I'm also co-founder of one of the largest food tech companies in the U.S., Territory Foods, where I architected the menu planning algorithm based on consumer tastes. And before all of this, I worked in consulting for quite a while, supporting geospatial visualization services across the federal government and predictive analytics initiative to curb veteran homelessness. So buckle up and get ready. Let's tackle uncharted territory in AI today with curiosity as our guiding star. Today's episode features Eric Pellier, a leader in technology innovation, having founded over 15 companies that span across blockchain, digital media, and cloud computing. His journey has led to raising over $1 billion and achieving significant exits from IPOs to mergers. With an impressive academic background from Harvard University, Eric has carved out a reputation as a technologist, author, and philanthropist dedicated to advancing the digital landscape. As co-chair of the AI Coalition at Future Investment Initiative, FII Institute, Eric is helping to drive AI ethics in the right direction by mapping out key priorities and creating guidelines. Eric's also leading Batim as their CEO, shaping the future of digital interaction through the integration of AI and blockchain. And Eric is also the co-founder of Exponential Ventures, an AI fund and venture studio. Just for a little bit of background, folks, the FII AI Coalition drives impactful change in AI and robotics, education, healthcare, and sustainability. It's grounded in ESG principles, and the Institute aims to unite decision makers and innovators to shape a brighter future to co-create solutions for a sustainable world. And for those of you that aren't familiar with Batim, it's a user-friendly Web3 wallet and creator of engaging interactive NFTs that offer rich digital experiences. These advancements include the introduction of smart NFTs, which are transforming how global brands connect with their audiences. Hi, Eric. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Man, you gave me a lot to say there. I might have to take a sip of water after that intro.
I don't know who gave it to you, but we're grateful.
Well, we've really had a chance to get to know each other in the Venice Beach sort of tech corridor and globally over the last few years. And, you know, it's a true honor to have you on the show and get into, you know, a topic that you know well, which is this sort of intersection of all these emerging technologies. I don't know how someone found 15 companies. Like, I've done a couple and I feel like, man, that's enough for a lifetime.
It's pathological. Yeah.
At what point in your career did AI and machine learning enter the picture?
Oh, wow. I would have to say that I can't remember a time when it wasn't in the picture. Of course, there's been so many twists and turns and levels of realness to the dream that is continuing now on this exponential curve. But I remember back, it's my earliest days. When I was in fourth grade, probably 10 years old, my father was one of the first people to bring home a computer that was small enough to fit in the home. It was a Sol 20 8080 processor. And it was, I remember the OS was CPM. We were just learning the very basics of what does this thing even do with a little tape, you know, that you would record on. And one of the first programs that I saw that actually blew my mind, that made me think like, what's going on in there, was this thing called ELIZA, which I think was actually invented maybe even a year or two before I was born. It was very simple. I don't know the exact mechanism, but it's the equivalent of probably if-then statements and repeating back to you as kind of Rogerian psychotherapist model, where it would say, oh, that's interesting that you said so-and-so. What did you mean by that? But it wasn't extremely insightful or had any idea what you were writing, but it tricked you even then. Well, I mean, the Turing test was miles into the future, but it was mind-boggling. And from that moment on, I've always been a, I would say, an enthusiast.
Wow. Yeah, so it's pretty much embedded in your DNA at this point.
Yeah.
And obviously, the ethical considerations around sort of AI and you know, having fun with all this new age technology has been a major sort of media focus as of late, and definitely has sort of taken priority in social circles as well. I am curious, like, when did this sort of the ethical considerations around AI become top of mind for you, and what made you decide to jump into this role at FII?
So it's interesting. The real attention to the ethical dilemma, to the extent that we're looking at it now, is only a few years old, and maybe at a fever pitch for 18 months, and in the last 6 months, it's dominant. But even I can say from my view, while it still remains heavily fueled by optimism, the first time I ever stepped back and really said, well, wait a minute, is this exponential curve going to get away from us in a way that we can't counter it as fast as I thought we could with you know, countermeasures, was when I saw TikTok, actually. I was okay with some of the stuff happening, maybe, you know, as an idiot, I guess, looking back on certain things now as I look at how social media has evolved and its effects on society and what we need to do now.
Well, started with like online dating, right? I mean, that was where we started to just like share everything with technology.
Yeah, online dating was a big thing. You know, we certainly have shifted into a mode where privacy is just not a consideration for most people. And then the exploitation of that data has become epidemic. But what happened with TikTok, it actually started as a music app. But the notion of how to suck someone into a doom scrolling cycle and actually know what they would want to do next and measure things in milliseconds and get ahead of what the human brain is capable of understanding, thinking that you're making decisions, but actually being led, I started to recognize that we're now in a different era.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I guess part of that realization is that for whatever reason, we as humans are drawn towards negative sentiment, not positive sentiment, right? And a lot of the content consumption that our sort of Neanderthal brains sort of choose to click on happens to be a little bit more on the negative side. And that, of course, leads to sort of other implications from there.
Absolutely. And Peter Diamandis, my friend and partner, famously calls the CNN the crisis news network. The notion that the way to be rewarded is not necessarily to find the most uplifting or beneficial stories or ways of, you know, elevating you to the next level for your benefit, but it's to get you to click on something, to consume more media, to consume more advertising, to buy something perhaps. And there are techniques to do that. And of course, we're hardwired to react to negativity and fear.
Yeah, it's a dopamine hit. So I guess that sort of brings about the importance of, you know, an institute like FII and sort of why someone like yourself might be motivated to play a key leadership role there. What exactly is the work that you're doing at FII, and how is it sort of trying to address these global risks and align us as a society?
Yeah, I am motivated to be part of that and honored to be asked to participate. The quality of the people that are involved, first of all, got me very excited. You know, I can learn much more than I teach, but I also gain insights and hopefully I'm contributing to the initiatives, which ultimately are about looking at how to align the trajectory of AI with humanity's best interest. It's that simple, right? Left to its own devices, it's value neutral. Like anything, like a knife that can be used to cut your food or to create harm. This is similarly, but magnified times a trillion. And the ability for this to cause harm is indisputable. There are those like myself who are extremely optimistic about what we can do with this technology to solve humanity's grandest challenges. But we can't deny that there are looming disaster scenarios on the horizon that we can foresee, some of which are incidents that we can start to chart out and map and be ready for, some of which are trends that are already undermining, I believe, the fabric of society or the type of world we want to live in.
Yeah. That makes sense. So, you know, we got to get people together. We have to have these open forums that cross like the public sector, the private sector. You all just did that at the Asia FII Priority Summit in Hong Kong, one of those cities that's been on my radar to get to sooner than later. And I guess you did that back in December. What were some of the takeaways, the key discussion points, resolutions that came out of those conversations?
So I would say that what's happening is that the mission is gelling. Riyadh, where the kind of larger meeting for FII takes place, was where the set of challenges were put forward. The AI resolution for humanity was put out. That's really our manifesto, if you will, about our goals to what we're going to do to align government and commercial and investment community around these very important set of principles. And then what happened in Hong Kong is we started to wrap our arms around the substantive projects that now have to be put into action. It's one thing, you see a lot of these groups around the world doing interesting work and creating interesting debate, but what we don't have time to debate this much longer. We have to act. And so what happened in Hong Kong, I think, is we started to hone in on the highest priorities that we're going to act against and who's in, who wants to help. We have leaders in industry, leaders in the financial community, ministers of government, prime ministers, heads of state. We have people who see their job as continuing humanity forward, but also creating a better world. And if you look at some of these pieces, we can start to say, look, I think we can wrap our arms around an AI blueprint. We can start to make something that says, if I'm a government or a massive government-sized company, and I want to deploy AI for the betterment not only of ourselves, but for humanity, here are the considerations. You have an underlying, say, AI Bill of Rights. You have an underlying set of infrastructure resources. And you know, as you go up this stack and you start to look at what's necessary, you start at the bottom with this ethical framework, and you go at the top to what are the top priorities, the risks that you have to address, the most pressing concerns, and then what are the most pressing and important areas that you can make an impact with. When you map these out, you can then start to address how to deal with them. One of the most important initiatives, which we can talk about, or I would say one of the more interesting ones to me personally, is what we call the Cultural Preservation Project. And that has to do with what it means to carry on ancestry into the future in a world where AI, trained in a, say, a very limited set of facts, is going to infiltrate every aspect of society.
Yeah, that's really an interesting observation you guys made, I guess, through this dialogue, because people sort of think about the doomsday scenarios, but yeah, it does sort of potentially have the risk of reshaping history and changing how people reflect on the world as we know it today, right? Were there any other key priorities that jumped out to you in terms of that initiative? And I think it's an important part of the process, right? Because there's a lot going on here. I was just at an AI meetup a few days ago. And, you know, you could spend hours talking about all the different risks associated with AI, and putting that priority stack together is really important. So any other sort of top priorities that jumped out?
Yeah, look, some of these priorities overlap, right? So I can name a few. Some are on the things that we must address proactively and look towards solutions. Some are more opportunistic. If we look, for instance, at let's say election interference, right? We're seeing a rise of deepfakes. We know for a fact that there's going to be a absolute torrent of fake news, as an understatement, of candidates saying things they never said, of news video that portrays things that will sway opinion one way or the other, but is entirely artificial. And so what can you do about that? This is a cat and mouse game. Certainly you go after certain obvious elements of getting a consensus around tagging things that are not fake, being able to identify them and separate them from the others. But that doesn't stop the bad actors. You therefore need to have a readiness to act when, not if, but when these events unfold, and start to play that out in scenarios. A number of interesting groups are doing that. We're courting them and learning from them and trying to add to that. Same thing as you start to look into things like synthetic biology and the ability to make pathogen kits at home. You know, it's not tomorrow, but it might as well be, for the effect that it's going to have on the biological life left on the planet. We already saw what happened with, you know, some pathogens escaping from Wuhan. What's going to happen when these can be sent at the speed of light, like email, and reconstituted on biological 3D printers, and to create the deadly pathogens? We're going to end up with a set of countermeasures and anticipatory actions that must be understood now. And this is part of the work. It's important work. I think it's very rare to find somebody in a position of influence or power that spends time on this subject that doesn't want to get involved. And so we are in a privileged position to really have, I think, aggregated some of the more interesting and motivated people on the planet. But make no mistake, we are not handing out solutions. We are gathering people to look for them.
Yeah, it's not, these aren't problems that can get solved overnight. And, you know, just what you've brought up makes me think about like cybersecurity and cybercrime and sort of nefarious actors in terms of global power, and how that could sort of be impacted by this mix of these different industries advancing at the same time. It's not just the advancement of AI, it's how that converges with the advancement of weapons technology and the advancement of biological sort of technology, like you mentioned. And you combine all that together and you get an incredible amount of opportunity and an incredible amount of new risk for humanity, right?
No, you absolutely do. I mean, just think about, just reacting to what you just said, the weaponization of LLMs is staggering. And it's not, this is not a big leap. Like, we have several leaps to go before the 3D kits are printing DNA, and you can see it happening, and you can see things that we're going to have to address. But right now, today, the ability for a kid in their basement to start to manipulate an LLM to go out on a phishing attack at scale, and to convince you as a susceptible person to any type of friendship interest or, you know, human connection bait, you're going to fall into a trap that is far more dangerous than ever before. And by the way, because these things can be done cheaply and at scale on low-cost, ubiquitous networks, you can afford to do it wrong and then through an evolutionary process get better and better at it with these algorithms until some, you know, small but meaningful percentage of everyone it touches, it's sucking dollars out of and destroying lives in the wake. This is going to happen today.
What you just brought up makes me sort of think about that ridiculous reality TV show Catfish and like the ability of all of us to be catfished in a number of ways that, you know, we couldn't have even have imagined, right? Like, you know, my Instagram account has been, you know, catfished several times, and it's an annoyance. But when this AI and my friends just, they know pretty quickly, this is not a real person. Hey, I reported this, you know, imposter profile. But what happens when, you know, people can catfish you in a profoundly realistic way and get people to, like, you know, take a drive across the country or just, you know, distract them from their work and what they care about. It could be a very muddy, convoluted reality that we all live in.
Yeah, it really can. So for every positive application, and there are many there, I mean, the positive applications, we're focusing on some of the risks because that's part of our job is to identify them and to try to get ahead of them. But we don't want to overemphasize that at the risk of forgetting that these technologies are enormously powerful for so many things that can actually elevate us, that can bring billions of people out of poverty, that can create wide-scale educational increases at a rate that we've never seen before, and change the way that medicines are discovered and built, and personalized healthcare is delivered. And the list goes on of the kind of mind-boggling benefits to humanity we're starting to see and we can imagine in the coming years. At the same time, this power, this hammer, is going to be used in these other ways, as you know, correctly point out. And some of these are perhaps not widely understood because some of them are big bang problems, like, oh my gosh, this virus just got released, or, you know, this weakness in the global financial system has now been identified. And, you know, there are some massive calamitous things that you can look at and start to prepare for. But there's something else, you know, this analogy of boiling the frog, where the frog will stay in the pot as you rise the heat. If you obviously turn it right on, it'll hop out. But if you rise very slowly, the frog hangs out and then naturally boils itself to death. Well, this is what's happening with some of the more insidious and problematic aspects of this, especially when it comes for these AIs to now converse in human language and become better and better at simulating humans, creating certain types of emotional relationships and connections that are going to take us even farther down the path that I think a lot of us think is problematic. So Instagram, TikTok, some of these seemingly innocuous at first fun apps that were social actually created widespread disconnection, widespread depression, widespread loneliness, a sense of feeling empty inside. And, you know, very subtly at first, and then as an epidemic. And here we have an opportunity to say, well, how do we apply these technologies to reverse that trend, to bring people together? But make no mistake, at the same time as this is happening, as we're envisioning this and trying to build new systems that maybe have a different outcome, the forces of capitalism, not just fraud, not just bad actors, but pure money-seeking behemoths, are preying increasingly with the assistance of advanced AI to create emotional connections with people, which further disconnect us from what is most important to create purposeful, meaningful lives.
So I hear what you're saying about sort of this the implications of AI and its ability to control and direct human attention. And we talked about this sort of before the podcast, and it got me thinking about it for the last few days. And actually I went to another event and sort of brought it up to a pretty interesting group of folks. And their reaction was surprising to me, which is, aren't we giving sort of technology more credit than credit is due? Where maybe this is just sort of a broader societal trend, and it doesn't matter what technology we integrate into the conversation, we're moving in this direction as a society, and technology is really just an enabler. And if it's not AI, it's some other sort of technology like gaming or whatnot that distracts us from connection. How would you respond to that?
I would say it's an interesting argument. And if the premise weren't fundamentally flawed, I would applaud it and agree with, you know, some of the implications that that brings us. It certainly lets us off the hook in certain areas. But the premise is actually not right. To conflate AI with other technologies falls into the trap of a kind of pattern recognition that I think is lazy. Because we've seen so much hype before, and then it just becomes yet another thing. Okay, it's something we can deal with. This is not that. I don't believe that this is the case. AI is not just another thing. The internet wasn't just another thing, right? The internet was systematic in terms of its effect on every aspect of healthcare, education, government, you know, name your thing. And yeah, we adjusted, but it did really reorder society and to some degree what it means to be human. We've extended our prefrontal cortex to the sum total of human knowledge and low-cost networks, and it's changing every aspect, I think, of even how our brains work, the type of creativity we do, the output, the institutions we build and govern. But that's nothing compared to increasingly intelligent beings that are moving at exponential speed. I wouldn't say beings, I don't want to overstate, but these AIs that are advancing at exponential rates and are getting increasingly better at simulating humans. And even if they're not simulating humans, at doing things that humans can do, the notion of AGI, of being able to actually do better than most people, most things that have economic value, is a very, very real deal here. This is not business as usual. I mean, Sundar Pichai from Google likens it to the invention of fire. I don't know if I go that far, but I don't think it's that wrong. I mean, we're talking about changing every aspect of our economy and how we interact with the world around us. Now, here's the most important thing that I would contest, or at least I would ask people to think about in what you just said. We are biologically wired to connect. That's where we find our most important nourishment for the soul, if you will, for what makes us human, for what gives us purpose. And the less we connect, you can still function. You can still be, you know, increasingly robotically and increasingly maniacally, you can function, but you can't function happily. You can't function well, where well is defined as having the ground under your feet and living your best life. And what happens with these bots is they're creating false connection. That's where we already are, right? You're creating friends, this empty zero calorie diet that's starving you to death. And you look up and you say, oh, I got all these friends. Why do I feel so lonely? But now imagine that these friends are not just these, you know, FOMO pictures of people on beaches, you know, outwitting you and ads outwitting you, et cetera, but they're actual beings that are creating an emotional connection, that are getting smarter and less lazy than actual friends, and smarter and less lazy than actual romantic connections, drawing you in to the point where you are helpless to do anything but connect deeper and deeper. That type of connection draws you farther away from what matters most. What matters most is our biological affinity to be attracted to the natural world and to the other biological elements in this world. That's why, and I just want to be clear about that. That's why no matter how smart AIs get and how much like humans they are, it's great for efficiency and it's great for many things, even creativity and to give you superpowers. It's not going to be great for human connection. It's not going to be great for connection to nature because they're not human. They're not biological. Yeah, they're not natural. And they create a trend that in effect is ripping us apart. And our only hope is to recognize that, not take it lightly. Oh, it's just another thing. It's actually an accelerator of the negative aspects of the technology revolution. And to step back, turn off your screen sometime, go for a walk, hold hands, stare in someone's eyes, don't look away, you know, kiss longer, like you mean it, your life depends on it, because it does.
Wow. Yeah, it's sort of like the pursuit of perfection incarnated, right? Like we want the perfect car, the perfect mate, the perfect vacation, the perfect job. But if AI gives it to us, the game is over and we're going to feel more empty than we've ever felt in our entire lives.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. And it's boiling that frog. Getting back to a base upon which we can build again, a human-centric view, not only for the present, but for how we're designing the future, that is a choice. And it's a choice that isn't necessarily solved just with better tech or countermeasures. Human connection must rise to the top, and there's no app for that. There's no app for that.
Yeah. And by the way, like I was playing devil's advocate, because something about the response from that group didn't sit with me, and I was trying to figure out what was wrong. Cause like, I was like, well, first of all, I think it's generally a pessimistic, defeatist mindset, but more so, I think it comes from this place of human first and sort of who are we as humans and what are our sort of needs to feel fulfillment in society, right? And if you just deny what those human needs are and you supplant these requirements with this laissez-faire attitude, then ultimately society is going to become quite empty.
That's right. There's a massive difference between enhancement and replacement. Enhancement is fantastic. Yeah, what an amazing world we're about to step into. The abilities that we're going to have to augment us to become musicians and singers and poets, not just cheating, not plagiarizing, not lazily handing off, you know, our expression to a bot, but giving us these superpowers that allow us to fulfill the best part of ourselves, to enhance our creativity, to even join together to create communal works of art and find ways to laugh together and build together. There's wonderful augmentations that are coming to what it means to be human, but it doesn't replace the human. It will in society, by the way. It will in jobs. We do have a major thing we have to deal with. We're going to wipe out something like 40% of all the current jobs. I mean, it's probably an understatement by a large number. But that's a different topic. It's an important topic, but it's a different one. We have to address replacing the old jobs with the new and what we're going to do in that gap and that interim to make sure that we minimize suffering and maximize the potential of people to gain all the benefits of this new society we're building. At the same time, we have to make a statement. I've often noted that if I were to give you a a poem and tell you that it was written by a bot and give a control group, maybe an experimental versus control group, as the same poem and tell them it was written by a human with a backstory and pain and joy and a narrative associated with what it meant to get there as a biological being. The entire experience of that very same poem is different simply because it's human. There's no difference in the output. Humanness matters because it does. If you base your next generation of society on that premise, I think we're going to have the opportunity to marshal these astounding forces to our collective benefit.
Let's shift a little bit to sort of the how. So you prioritize the risks, you get the right folks together, then it comes down to execution time and mitigating these risks as much as possible. It seems complicated in terms of what aspects of that execution phase happen at a global level versus a country level versus a local jurisdictional level. How should these things actually come to be? And to what extent does that depend upon the industry, whether or not it's more public sector focused or private sector weighted?
This is definitely a public-private partnership matter. Those who go too far on either side, I think, are not thinking this through clearly. This is a highly nuanced, not easy, but doable problem, you know, or challenge to address. We have on one side those who will push for massive and fast regulation at the expense of the need for coalitions of the willing, if you will. That makes no sense. The governments don't have enough information yet to regulate effectively. And even if they did, who's really driving them? And are they suspect? Remember, regulation tends to be written not by the regulators or the government officials, but by the lobbyists and those who direct them to regulate. And what are they going to regulate? Whatever is best for them. They're going to start to say, oh, this is too dangerous. Like, don't release open source. Well, guess who doesn't want to release open source? The closed source guys, right? Why? Oh, it's too dangerous. Come on now. The messenger and the message are too intertwined to allow that to run off. And suddenly you have laws that stifle creativity and enforce the status quo before an even new status quo has been effectively allowed to emerge. It's not right.
We have these situations where getting every country to agree to the same policies is virtually impossible. Right. And unlike something like NATO, where you don't have everyone on board, but you have most people on board, in this case, you know, the technology runs amok if one party is not sort of playing by the same set of rules. So is this a global governance issue? Is this something where countries should and can make some of these decisions independent of other countries?
Yes, you have to. There is no such thing as global governance, and there's no such thing as global ethics, you know, even. Like, you'd think that there's some basic human rights that we all agree on. Nope. Turns out it's not the case. Now, there are groups that have like-minded objectives that can and should collaborate. And in fact, they are and we are. And I think that that's part of the beauty of the FII's role is it doesn't just meet once a year, right? It met in Riyadh. We did Hong Kong. We're doing Miami next week. We'll go to South America. We'll go to Africa, et cetera. But what it does by having its frequency of meetings and the nature of the people that are coming together and its neutrality to a certain degree, it can bring together those who have at least a set of shared principles to say, we care enough about this to collaborate. At the same time, it can encourage a set of non-regulatory frameworks where people willingly sign up for and maybe get incentives within their government to abide by rules that will allow us to make proper decisions. Sometimes people don't even know if bias has seeped into their AIs that are driving the curriculum of their educational system. Well, how do you test for bias? How do you know what's happening? That's super important. So these things, you know, need to come from both sides. And some things are actual private-public partnerships from the beginning. Like take the cultural preservation program. This is what I like to call the New Deal. The New Deal in America was, let's take some capital and put people to work to improve the economy. We'll build bridges, we'll build roads, we'll build tunnels, we'll build infrastructure that will help the community and help the economy. The new infrastructure, the new deal, is cultural preservation. We now need to take that capital and instead of just building physical infrastructure, build the underpinnings of preserving ancestry into the future, of going to the people, the older people perhaps even, and getting their recipes, their bedtime stories, their narratives, the patterns on their walls, the multimodal input that we can get from observing them into a safe and secure local model, a model that's so local might even be on their own cell phone and then aggregated into a local model for the community. You have to have a local model for the community or the norms and practices and standards and culture and flavor of your culture is going to be wiped out. You're going to be thought of as like a sitcom version, if at all noticed by the AIs. You know, what's interesting, when you do a search in Google, you'll get, you know, a messy set of returns, but people even now barely go past the first page to get a whole bunch of things. Imagine if you're asking something and you don't even get that. You just get an answer. Okay, tell me about rugs in Morocco. Tell me about bedtime stories here. Tell me about hiccup cures here. It'll be whatever it knows. It's just because it's wrong doesn't mean it's not certain. And you're just going to be run over as a society if you don't start to preserve what you hold dear now. So every country in the world is going to embark on something like this. And we can encourage these groups to collaborate. We can give roadmaps for how to do it. We can show reference implementations and we can guide them to do this before it's too late.
That's great. Yeah, it seems like a critical initiative because, you know, the data that AI is using is as good as its inputs. And if the inputs are heavily weighted towards certain societies, certain genders, certain demographics, certain beliefs, then that's going to become sort of the norm. It's going to normalize over the whole data set if it dominates it, right? How does that affect sort of domains like criminal justice and social justice and sort of what comes to mind there in terms of how AI can, if we don't do what you're saying, cause some real challenges?
We're going to have these challenges whether or not we do what I'm saying, but it will help start to create a permanent reminder of where we came from, where we're going. We do need to vet this input, right? As we train these local models for how do we want to adjudicate our criminal justice system and what is our culture and what do we want to bring forward? We don't want to be stuck in the past. We just want to have access to it. We still want to advance. Turning over your, you know, criminal justice system or your judges to an AI is obviously a recipe for disaster because there's too many subtle nuances. Now, then again, you can eliminate bias in humans, or not eliminate, but you can diminish the bias in humans by coupling them with a co-pilot, as Microsoft would say, but with an augmented assistant that has command of more information and capability than you have as a single human and can help you maybe make more reasonable decisions. But I think we're in a position right now where we have to intervene now so that we can make a statement and set a direction that we don't inevitably end up with systems talking to systems with systemic risk if any one of the weak links breaks or has, you know, has a bad actor that take control of it. This not only is the criminal justice system, but let's say in the financial system, where these automated traders are making decisions based on other bots, which are triggering other bots, which are, you know, doing things automatically with large amounts of capital if other things happen. And but by a human even understands what's going on, you can trigger a domino effect of cataclysmic proportion. So it's important for us to intervene now.
Well, let's take a little detour for a moment, and then we'll tie these two worlds together. You know, I know in your mind, everything sort of fits seamlessly together already, but you happen to sort of have another side of your background, which is, you know, deep in the world of blockchain and non-fungible technology. In fact, like for those that dump with sort of smart NFTs, and that was a big breakthrough. It's changed my life. It's changed my career. You know, I never would have started the show Edge of NFT or done all these events globally. So there's a bit of a domino effect in the world that you created there. And I'm grateful to you for that. Where did you come up with this idea? And when you started this, what were some of the use cases that came to mind?
So it's interesting. I had been exposed to blockchain technologies, you know, quite a bit earlier. I was looking at it from more of an enterprise perspective, which is a lot of my work has been. I was getting increasingly frustrated with the enterprise adoption of blockchains. One, because they were being applied to problems they shouldn't be applied to. A lot of the stuff that they were being applied to was better done centralized. Other things were there was a lot of regulatory issues that were creating a molasses pace. But I always believed very early on that the most important innovation about this shift to a next generation internet, an internet that would be more equitable, more empowering to everyone and not just concentrate power, would start with the idea of self-sovereign ID, would start with the idea that you own your own stuff. Ownership is not a concept that was built into the internet. Information, free flowing of information, and ubiquitous and low cost access to it was built in, but you don't own when you go to one website or another, you're not you. You're registering as into their system. They're making you an identity. They own the data. You're signing away into that world, and then you go somewhere else, and you're another you again, owned by someone else. So I was fascinated by that, started working in that space. And one day I was sitting at my bar thinking about this dilemma and the unbelievable complex nature of what was facing us with applying blockchains to reordering the financial system and all these things about real estate and big institutions, banks. And I was like, I go all the other way, all the way the other way, and start with the notion of the most basic primitive, which is I'm me and I have a beer. And I happen to be sitting there with a beer in this plane of reality, right? So I'm thinking if you have the internet as a social and ownership overlay, the next generation of the internet as a social ownership overlay on the last one, then I need to be me. I need an identity and I need to be able to have my beer. So what if I could have that beer and it was not like a Bitcoin? Because at the time, all tokens were fungible. Everything was like everything else. You don't take one Bitcoin versus another. You can't see a Bitcoin. You can't poke it. Ethereum was out. But again, the Ethereums were all like one another either. There was no ERC-721 or anything like that. So the concept was, what if I could take a beer that was unique? It's my beer and I'm a human and I could put it on the table. And now I didn't have it anymore because I'm still here, but the beer is now in the table and it can be seen in augmented reality. Somebody else could pick it up and now they have it. So it's something that I owned went to someone else and then that they could give me a real beer, an i.e. a physical beer. So this idea that suddenly a digital object could have physical properties, could be unique in and of itself and retain its value as it moved from person to person or from person to business, and then could be magical, programmable, could change state. the beer could burst into confetti if the Lakers got over 100 points and turn into a taco, or if it was left out too long and didn't get picked up by someone, it could start to get warm and lose its value. It's just a programmable mini object, but it has the advantage on a blockchain of being uniquely identifiable, traceable, and scarce. You now have what I believed at the time would be a revolution in the nature of human engagement. If I give you something, then you are someone in the system. You are someone with something. And if you put in the right permissions and allow me to connect to you, you now have a direct conduit of communication. If Budweiser gave you that beer and you said, thank you, Budweiser, and they said, don't worry about it. You want another or you want to talk? You can say yes. You don't have to ask permission for these intermediaries anymore to talk to your own customers, to talk to your own audiences, to talk to your own fans. You can now emerge with an economy of value instead of annoyance. So my belief was if we could lay down that system, advertising would go away, replaced with a new value-based economy. And digital objects will become one of the most prevalent form of communication and the most powerful communication medium in the history of humanity would then become the wallet, your representation of your identity and your ability to decide personally who you want to interact with and when. And that was the beginning of what we then called Vadim. So everyone thought that NFT was too geeky a word, like non-fungible token, like no one's gonna get what that even is. I'm certainly believed that that would never take off and nobody would ever call it an NFT. So when thinking about what I really wanted to see with this, I was thinking about the dissolution of the boundaries between bits and atoms. And if you could make something out of imagination that was no less real than something made out of atoms, then you'd start a revolution. And that's what we called it, the Vadim, the virtual atom. And that became the first NFT.
And when was that?
Early 2015.
Yeah. So way back before crypto kitties and in fact, before I even learned about blockchain, you were already thinking about, you know, what we call these days NFTs. It's mind-blowing. There's another sort of conversation we probably have to have on our other show, Edge of NFT, but I am curious, when you sort of look at all the use cases that have come up here since that point in time, are there any that surprise you? And are there any use cases that, you know, when you mix with AI that you think are sort of readily accessible in the next run of utilizing this technology?
Yeah, for sure. Some things didn't surprise me or us. It was a merry band of really smart folks that came together to pursue this. But some things did, like, you know, I certainly felt that the first use cases of anything tend to be things like gambling. So, you know, if you can make something scarce, every five-year-old that draws something on a napkin is going to throw it in and sell it, you know, and people will speculate on it and what have you. But I was never really interested in that speculative economy so much. Sure, it's good if you own something, you have to have the right to sell it. It's part of the nature of ownership. Give it to someone and get value. But I was much more interested in how this can be used for things like engagement and gathering data in an ethical and legal way, and creating patent systems or a real estate title or entitlements for food. I can send you policy-based tokens that could be translated into electricity or gas or groceries, but can't be used for X, Y, or Z. That allows a different type of value to be sent, programmable policy-based money. And I really felt like that was the most interesting thing. Plus, coming from an enterprise background and the relationships that we have with the, you know, telcos and credit card companies and banks and consumer good companies, it became very natural to start to think about some of the early practical examples there. But if you really look at the bigger picture, and I wouldn't say it's surprising, I would say it's gratifying, of what's happening now. Not only is this becoming mainstream, I think commonplace, people are starting to recognize that this is just going to be how things work, but we're starting to see the emergence of really the most important aspect of where this might lead, which is everyone on the planet having a wallet, everyone on the planet owning their own data, and everyone on the planet being able to transact and express themselves and get paid. This is not just about top-down content. It's not just about selling you stuff or brands being able to address you. Even brands want to empower you, right? When you have a value-based economy, you're moving from advertising and annoying people. You're trying to find ways to align better with people, uplift them, create a connection. And sometimes that comes through delivering content and delivering gamification or something interesting to do. Sometimes it comes from enabling people to connect with one another in next generation communities and express themselves. But the most important thing that I think is what's interesting is this idea of decentralization. It's pretty darn real. Like, if you think about what happens, sure, a lot of it is bastardized now or not needed in places it was trying to put. But imagine what happens if everyone has their own self-sovereign ID and the ability to get a stable coin. Like, imagine that. Imagine I can send you a penny in another country for free, and you can take it out in your local currency. Now, imagine that penny was a stable coin that also paid some yield. Imagine you're sitting in an inflationary economy, I don't know, Venezuela or somewhere, that by the time someone gives you $5 for milk, you can't afford it anymore because the inflation's gone up. You can take your money, you can put it under your mattress. Someone can steal it. You can take your money, put it in a bank. The bank can close. The bank could freeze it. Inflation's still going up. What if you had a system? Oh, by the way, the other thing is, 1.7 billion people don't even have identification. they don't have a ID, let alone self-sovereign ID, so they can't get a bank account. So they're underbanked. So you have this situation where you're sitting here, you now can get a wallet simply by signing up for it. You can get a stable coin simply by having it sent to you. You can generate yield against that stable coin that might even start to, you know, rival banks or be better in some safe way, which I think we're seeing now, that is safer. You can have stable coins that are over-collateralized and are baskets of other assets, tokenized assets. And you're going to start to say, well, wait a minute, this is far more stable, sustainable, and equitable than this opaque, corrupt, fractional banking system. So I'm not saying that it's, you know, it's going to undermine the existing world order. What I'm going to say is that people are going to recognize that there's something really empowering and valuable here to leverage. And I think even the existing governments and banks, it's not about undermining them. It's about giving them a way to safely, I think, deploy next generation technology to elevate people and to give them standards of living and access to the financial services that we never could before.
Wow. There's a lot to marinate on that you shared. I will say, in spite of that, like, profound opportunity, there's a lot of essence in terms of our earlier conversation about your desire to connect people that I've found true to the world of NFTs through the membership experience. Like, I at NFTLA, and people met each other in person that had been part of communities for months, and their reunions were almost like they'd known each other for years, like centuries, in terms of their depth of connection that they felt. So in a lot of ways, I now appreciate sort of how this came about from this concept differently than I did before our conversation today. So I'm grateful for that. And we should definitely talk more about NFTs in a lot of different forms.
I would love to, especially I want to learn about your communities, because the networks that do tear us apart, it's not all bad. As I say, we want to augment, and being able to get people together that are not close geographically and create affinity groups that are not, you know, relegated by accident of birth and where you happen to be, and to connect that way, it has a lot of value. So I don't want to, you know, we're not throwing the baby out with the bathwater and say, let's not create online communities. In fact, we do want to. We just want to create better ones that enhance our experience.
Yeah, and there's obviously quite a lot of potential intersection points with AI ethics and NFTs and opportunities where I think NFTs could be beneficial. Also, probably some risks that are created if you combine these technologies without the right sort of forethought. Are there any sort of intersection points that you think are particularly underrepresented in terms of the conversations that are happening in the space and ideas that you have around how these two worlds intersect that you want to share?
Sure. I mean, it's interesting. Your conference, which is coming up, what's the date in March?
It's this year. It's actually more decentralized. It's a NFT LA community week this time around, because, yeah, you know, you don't necessarily need a conference to create a community, or a community doesn't necessarily need one place to go. It exists throughout LA, right?
Yeah, it does. And I think for those of you in town, we'll be hosting a gathering at Batom House and talking about that. And I think we'll make some announcements there that maybe answer your question a little better about how some of these technologies are coming together, because we've had some insights that are, I think, no less profound or interesting than the first NFTs that we can start to bring to the communities and ask people to play with. Like all these things, the value isn't in the idea, it's in the execution, it's in the people that come together to explore it and bring it to life. And really appreciative of what you've done for the LA community, and I'd like to contribute to that. And so we'll make some announcements and throw some things out there. So just a little teaser for that one. I think the other thing that you're going to see in the coming months is a real adoption by the mainstream groups. The companies that typically put their toe in the water for quite some time before it just becomes part of how they work. I remember when I was asking everyone to get a website. They're like, why would I want a website? You know, I've got a brochure, I got a TV commercial. Eventually, no one asked, why would I want a website? They asked, you know, how do I get a better one? Well, the same thing's happening with these technologies, and the convergence of these technologies for practical purposes is now hitting a tipping point where people aren't asking like, well, should I do it? They're asking, how do I do it better? How do I make it effective? How does it affect the bottom line? How do I do it ethically? And so what you're going to see in the coming months are things like grocery stores that are going to be able to accept NFTs. You're going to see, large banks that are going to be able to use these for loyalty systems, and automotive companies and organizations, even segments of governments are going to be not just looking at how do they stop bad actors, but how do they empower good ones? We're at a tipping point where this technology has gone through an experimentation phase, and now we're going into an implementation phase.
Well, very exciting. And this has been a really incredible conversation. We have another segment I want to transition to, and we'll try to be swift with it because there's a lot to unpack in our earlier conversation. I didn't want to cut off the dialogue, but if you're up for it, we'll do AI Wants to Know. Sound good?
Yeah, sure.
All right. So these are 10 quick questions to uncover the intriguing human mysteries that AI longs to comprehend but can't quite grasp. It's a snack break in our journey, so keep the answers quick, but the safety belt sign is off. So it feels right, we can occasionally roam about the cabin exploring more. First question, what's the first thing you ever remember being proud of?
I think my first omelet that I was able to flip without flopping it over and ripping it, that really perfect, just remember the beauty of the edges. It's quite extraordinary.
The French omelet, it's a remarkable thing. What do you need help with that you wish you didn't?
Directions. If you see me wandering about after this podcast, just remind me where I live. I will be out in the exact opposite direction, happily, but eventually I'll need a little assistance.
There we go. I do have someone I'm very close to in my life with the same sort of challenge there, but you know,
the handicap.
What do others often look to you for help with?
I would say being calm in the storm when a crisis warrants clear thinking. I think I'm often looked to for that, but also hopefully equally storm in the calm for what's needed when there isn't, when it's time to shake it up, to look at it from a different angle, to challenge how things worked. So maybe if I could put it on the positive side of where I think I might add that kind of value, would be calm in the storm and storm in the calm.
There we go. We've got that happening with AI for sure. What do you treasure most about your human abilities?
I would say compartmentalization. I don't know if that's a human ability that one's born with or one learns, but it's certainly one that I've been tested to not only learn, but to hone as a necessary part of how I present in the world, because for whatever reasons, I've often been set with a set of conflicting and highly burning fires, things that need attention all at once. I started my journey as an entrepreneur building things, and was obviously entrepreneurs always have a complex set of plates to juggle. But I found myself with, as a single parent with a 1, 3, 5, and 7-year-old quite a few years ago, 20 years ago, and also having been the poster child for the first tech crash, having lost probably $300 million in that moment. Not that I ever had it, but you know how that goes. But the combination of needing to be present, be not just faking it, but actually having the ability to hug like you mean it, you know, to laugh genuinely while something over here really must be attended to, is the nature of compartmentalization. And it allows you to build a company, to be a father, to be a friend, to be a son. Not that I'm doing any of those as well as I would like to, not claiming anything like that, but I am claiming that my abilities to navigate are largely due to how well I function with that trait.
Beautiful. And you might have slightly alluded to this already, but throughout your whole life, what is the most consistent thing about you?
It's interesting. Can't really explain this, I guess, but since as the earliest memories of me being conscious, I feel like I'm on psychedelic mushrooms. I've never entered into.
I mean, you live in Venice; they're probably like permeating the air around here.
Maybe my mother was into this, and I got into utero, but I've never like entered a room and just felt like I'm seeing it the same way as others. Like, why is that moving? And I think sometimes I'm either missing the bigger thing or missing the smaller thing, but I'm seeing things that maybe are distracting me from some things I should be doing. But I'm like, wow, why is that way? Why is there a different fork and spoon? Why aren't all things sporks? So like, you know, and I can't help but kind of see things in a very humorous light as a result. things I'm very good at amusing myself, I would say. from an early age.
Looking like a true inventor. And throughout your whole life, what has changed the most?
Things have changed so much. I'm so hyper aware of the exponential curve. I mean, the brain just can't comprehend exponential curves. So I've been so attractive to the philosophy of Peter Diamandis early on, who taught me a lot of this, even as I've read it and believed it long ago. But to figure out how to articulate this massive curve that we're on, I remember when I was in college, I can't remember who pointed this out to me. It might have been a professor or someone, but sometime when I was around 18, I realized that if you were to fold a notebook, a piece of thin notebook paper in half, it would double in width, and fold it again in half, it would double again, and then fold it again. And if mysteriously or magically you could keep folding it without the laws of physics getting in the way of its foldingness, you can kind of figure out how many folds would it take to get from here to the moon or here to the sun, right? It would eventually get there. And then the big revelation is, and then how long would it take, how many more folds to get back after you made it all the way to the sun? And the answer is just one more. It doubles again. And that's what we don't understand about doubling. Doubling is massive. And so in my lifetime, 57 years old, I've seen this doubling. I didn't have a cell phone in college. You know, when somebody wanted to call me, you know, they would call and I'd have to be by the phone. I was able to go on a walk and think about things without getting buzzed and texted and someone getting insulted because I didn't text back fast enough, or worrying, you know, this notion of being interrupted constantly by this barrage of inputs. I believe that what's changed most, even though so much for the better, look at almost every metric of humanity, even poverty, war, all the things that news tells us is getting worse, is actually getting better. But one thing I don't believe is, and that's our EQ, our readiness and talent to connect with one another, I think is eroding in light of what's been handed to us for so many benefits. But if I could identify one of the biggest changes, I would say people's tolerance for one another in person versus electronically.
I appreciate you sharing that. What do you find strangest about reality?
Oh, wow. It is a weird place, isn't it? I think it's...
Especially the way you describe it.
I think it's really weird that we get up in the morning with a instinct and knowledge that the most important thing that we can do is connect with one another, and we go to sleep at night recognizing that we've prioritized everything else.
Yeah. We go straight into disconnect mode, check our phones, do things independently. Very rarely do I like call my mom first thing in the morning. I'm going to call my mom tomorrow morning. You've inspired me.
Yes, do. And then call her and tell her that you're coming over, not just, you know, take it the next level.
You got it. When most recently do you remember feeling alive?
My most recent memory of that sensation, recognition, memory. Oh, yeah, I'm alive. Because you forget not only you're alive, but you're this highly unlikely combination of elements that are spinning around the sun on this rock. And you're like, wow. And I'm breathing and I can feel it. Like you, those moments don't always come. Sometimes you're doing what you need to do. And for me, I had a moment because I became an empty nester recently, and I remember whenever I'm on a trip or whatever, trying to rush back for something or there's a crisis of some sort. And I had this moment where the dogs were at a dog walker. There's nobody back here in LA. I was out giving a talk on, I was actually helping Rome trying to win the World Expo 2030, competing, ultimately Riyadh won that, but I was trying to make the case for what are the unique elements of Rome, and it was reminding me of this this long history that we've come from of art and creativity and what we need to do to step back to realize our ability to participate in that, not just consume it. And I kind of snapped out of it and say, wow, I'm actually talking about this stuff here in Paris. And I went, I had some friends having a birthday party in Ibiza. I went there and I jumped in the Mediterranean and it took it the next level. I suddenly felt alive. The water rushed over me. Everything tingled. My brain shifted focus. And I don't think I've been the same since. I think I've remembered that I'm alive ever since. And it's interesting because I don't think I did before.
Wow. Well, thanks. Thanks for sharing that intimate story. I feel alive every time I do a cold plunge, and I've been doing them more often these days. I'm a little late to the game. You know, if you look at what Tony Robbins has been preaching for a long time, but getting into some water and just sort of being present is a really powerful feeling.
There's something about water and nature that's important. Like when I recognize this, and what's so important about, you know, connecting and not just being on the phones and being on the apps, but and connecting to people, not to AIs. It's also connecting to nature. Like we're biologically predisposed to be part of something bigger than ourselves. We are nature. We have to remind ourselves of how we fit and feel that physically to be grounded.
Right on. Just a couple more. What's your most unique trait?
Probably finding optimism when there's no reason to and no justification for it.
Cool. And if you weren't human, what would you be?
If I wasn't human, what would I be? Well, it's interesting. If I wasn't human, I guess I'd be the energy between us that flows through us and allows us to be creative. That's what I'd want to be. It's where we started before I was human. I think it's where I'm going after I am human. And I think I'd be, if I wasn't human, I think I'd be what I was prior. this energetic creative force that binds us. Some people might call it love, whatever you might call it. I think it's our role here to channel it for what short time we exist in this form.
Yeah. I'm sort of speechless here, but that makes sense intuitively. Just, I mean, that would be the kind of answer I expect from someone that started 15 companies and sort of created some game-changing technology, and sort of now that I've gotten to know you better on this show. So thanks for sharing that. And we normally do a bonus question. I'm going to sort of growth hack this situation here and ask the bonus question that would be one of our next segments, since we're running short on time, and just ask you, of all the folks you've met on your AI journey, are there any particular leaders that have influenced you and had a profound impact on how you see AI in the future?
Look, there's folks who have put their views out there that are highly influential and are brilliant. Maybe not my best friends. I'd love to know them better, but certainly I'm in awe of how they articulate some of the more important concepts. Mo Gadot, I think, is a really important one. I would say Mustafa Suleiman, is a really important one. I would say in my own orbit, the work that Peter Diamandis is doing, the work, in bringing this out with like Abundance 360 and his work with Singularity and XPRIZE and his podcasts and the people that he's helping to bring their articulations to life, I'm finding enormously powerful and honored to partner with him. And David Blundin, whose work with MIT and his focus on bringing novel talent out of MIT and out of his orbit into to have capital and to grow that. His track record is astounding, and to see the organization and the clear thinking happening there has been inspiring for me. And then there's a lot of folks in the periphery, you know, that are working every single day to advance these things, and not just to create the foundational models, but to create the ecosystem of the practical applications that are going to affect our lives. In fact, I would say that the work on the foundational models, while important, is really got a commodity curve that's also exponential. The value is going to approach zero, even though billions are floating in now. The value is going to shift entirely to the people, not necessarily building AI, but applying it. And the list is a mile long of who I'd like to mention. So apologies to those who are hoping to hear their name, but I'll tell you, as I've said before, I'm learning a lot more than I'm teaching.
Well, I learned a lot today, and I'm grateful and honored to have you on the show and to be part of a community that you helped catalyze. So we just want to sort of close by asking you where folks can go to learn more about you and all the projects you're working on.
Come to Harvell's and have a beer. That's the first one. Other than that, check out what's happening at the FII. Check out what's happening at Exponential Ventures. Check out what Peter's doing at Abundance 360 and Singularity University and XPRIZE. Check out vadum.com and see where we're going, and look at some of the announcements that are going to shift a little bit of what you think of our mission coming up in March. And come by Vadum House. We have gatherings, meetings of the minds. We break bread. We have campfires and music.
Yeah, I can attest. It's a great place. Had a chance to meet Neil Strauss at Vadum House at one of your gatherings, and he's become a friend and advisor. And so, yeah, you never know who you're going to meet when you head over to Vadum House. And it's always a good time. Well, for our listeners, it's time for another safe landing at the outer edges of the AI universe for today. This is your captain, and on behalf of our guest and the entire crew, I'd like to thank you for choosing to voyage with us today. We wish you a safe and enjoyable continuation of your journey. When you come back aboard, make sure to bring a friend. Our starship is always ready for more adventures. Head over to Spotify or iTunes right now. Rate us and share your thoughts. Visit us on YouTube if you're watching there, and hit the subscribe button. Your support and feedback means the world to us. Don't forget to visit edgeofai.xyz, where you can learn more about partnering, and you can check out our newsletter for the latest Edge of Company news, events, and show drops. In addition, connect with us on all major socials platforms by searching for edgeof_AI, and join us for other exciting conversations happening online. Before we sign off, mark your calendars for our next voyage, where we'll continue unraveling AI's mysteries and advancements. Until then, bye-bye.
The views and opinions expressed on Edge of AI reflect solely those views and opinions of the show hosts and its guests. Please make sure to do your own research. While we make every effort to ensure that the information about AI technology is accurate and up to date, we cannot guarantee its accuracy, completeness, or timeliness. We make no representations or warranties of any kind with respect to the information, products, or services discussed. Please be aware AI may occasionally generate incorrect or misleading information and produce offensive or biased content. Under no circumstances shall we be liable for any loss or damage, including without limitation, indirect or consequential loss or damage, or any loss or damage arising from loss of data or profits arising out of or in connection with the use of technology discussed on our podcast. Additionally, our show is not financial advice. You understand that you are using any and all information available on or through this podcast at your own risk. Whenever making financial decisions, we recommend doing your own research and talking to your accountant for financial advice. Lastly, time to time, we may feature sponsored content on the show for which we receive value, and we may share links for which we receive a commission if you make a purchase through one of these links. Refer to our website, edgeofai.xyz, for our full disclaimer, terms and conditions, privacy policy, and copyright notice. The views and opinions expressed on Edge of AI reflect solely those views and opinions of the show hosts and its guests. Please make sure to do your own research. While we make every effort to ensure that the information about AI technology is accurate and up to date, we cannot guarantee its accuracy, completeness, or timeliness. We make no representations or warranties of any kind with respect to the information, products, or services discussed. Please be aware AI may occasionally generate incorrect or misleading information and produce offensive or biased content. Under no circumstances shall we be liable for any loss or damage, including without limitation, indirect or consequential loss or damage, or any loss or damage arising from loss of data or profits arising out of or in connection with the use of technology discussed on our podcast. Additionally, our show is not financial advice. You understand that you are using any and all information available on or through this podcast at your own risk. Whenever making financial decisions, we recommend doing your own research and talking to your accountant for financial advice. Lastly, time to time, we may feature sponsored content on the show for which we receive value, and we may share links for which we receive a commission if you make a purchase through one of these links. Refer to our website, edgeofai.xyz, for our full disclaimer, terms and conditions, privacy policy, and copyright notice.